We are studying Book of Genesis, and I'm on page 104, down at the bottom, Genesis 21:22. It came about at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, or with my offspring, or with my posterity, but according to the kindness that I have shown you, you shall show to me and to the land in which you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I swear it. When we walk with the Lord like we should, people notice. And Abraham, in spite of his lack of his imperfections, is still seen by Abimelech and his chief commander as someone with whom God is dwelling. Certainly God had protected him from when he had taken Abraham's wife, and God had intervened, and he saw God was with him. And so he said, look, I want to make a deal with you, a covenant with you, because God is with you. And first, I don't want you to hurt me or mess with me. But he also wants the reflected glory of the blessing, that God will bless this land because you're here, and I want to participate in that. And we should ask the Lord to cause us to live in such a way as people would notice. We don't say anything, shouldn't say anything, unless they ask us. People would notice us, and they would say, I need to join whatever group you're in with God, because it's obviously working for you. So he seeks a covenant with Abraham for himself and his offspring. Unlike Lot, he is smart enough to seek a relationship with God's man, God's covenant bearer in the earth in this day. Lot, who we discussed earlier, separated himself from God's covenant bearer, God's man in the day, to his destruction. He was wealthy and had all kinds of sheep and money and servants and all kinds of things. And he got into a battle over wells. And rather than submit himself to the man who fathered him from the time he was a child, he pulled away out on his own and wound up losing everything. When we attach ourselves to the covenant bearer, in our case that's Jesus, we attach ourselves to the covenant bearer, we prosper as he prospers. When we separate ourselves from the covenant bearer, we are cursed. That which we have, we will lose. And we will not be able to obtain the things of God.
Anyway,
yeah.
Remind me who
Abimelech
is.
Abimelech is the king of the Philistines. He's in Gerar. Abraham has moved south toward Beersheba, and there he is in the land of the Philistines. And the Abimelech, actually the word Abimelech just means son of the king. And every king takes it, because he's the son of the next king. So he's like Pharaoh. Pharaoh is not somebody's name, it's a title. So is Abimelech. So Melech means king, like Melchizedek, king of Salem, you know, king of righteousness. So Melech means king, and the A-B-I-M part of it, remember the word for father, Ab, is from Abraham. So father, or son of the king, Abim, son of the king. And his son, who is going to deal with Isaac in a few chapters, is also called Abimelech, and he is the son of this guy. I want to make a deal with you. Abraham complained to Abimelech because of the well of water which the servants of Abimelech had seized. Now, Abraham is not likely to have said anything about this until Abimelech comes to him and says, I want to enter into a covenant friendship with you. Because when you're an alien in a foreign land and they got all the army and you got nothing, and somebody among them takes your well, what are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do about that? But Abimelech says, okay, I want to cut a covenant of friendship with you. And so Abraham says, well, all right, we can do that. Let's talk about my well. Because the well of water which the servants of Abimelech had seized. Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. Neither did you tell me, nor did I hear it until today. Abraham took sheep and oxen, and he gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Then Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what do these seven ewe lambs mean which you have set by themselves? And he said, you shall take these seven ewe lambs from me, from my hand, in order that it may be a witness to me that I dug this well." Abraham is actually buying his own well back from Abimelech to keep there from being strife. So they made a covenant at Beersheba. Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, arose and they returned to the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba. And there he called upon the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. Abraham sojourned in the land of Philistines for many days. So, call upon the name of the Lord is a biblical term for worship, usually group worship. And they called upon the name of the Lord. In fact, we talked about it was during the time of one of Adam's descendants that they began to call upon the name of the Lord. In other words, have church. So Abraham settles himself here, plants a tree, which is a sign that you're planning to stay a while. He's got a good working relationship with the king of this land. And so he settles in, and he wanders all over the land of the Philistines. He's a shepherd, he's called Meander, with impunity. And he lived there for many days. Only within a covenantal relationship can we safely complain to the king about perceived injustices. Remember Abraham telling God, negotiating with God over whether or not he would take out Sodom and Gomorrah, if there be 5 or 10 or whatever righteous men in there. Abraham's relationship with God was such that he could negotiate with God because their friendship allowed for it. But otherwise, it wouldn't. If we are walking with the Lord, we can negotiate with him. We can ask him to help us with this or that. We can even complain to him. We can say, "Lord, why is it that this has come upon me?" You know, and God will relate graciously to us. If we don't know him, we have no status on which to operate. We have no relationship on which to launch anything. So Abraham considers, let's see, any problem that can be solved with money is no real problem. Abraham considers relationship more important than possessions. He gives Abimelech sheep to get a clear title to a well that already belonged to him. He found the well, he dug the well, and by common law, he owned the well. But it was in Abimelech's country. And he wants to make sure that him complaining about the well and getting it back is not going to cause further damage or further... Abimelech goes home and he gets to ruminating and upset because this guy leveraged him for a well. And he says, "I'm giving you 7 ewe lambs to pay for this well. So I bought it from you. So you don't need to be feeling like you got messed over in this deal."
How long did it take him to build a well?
To dig a well?
Yeah, I mean...
Well, without trying to be funny, it depends on how deep the water was. But, you know, it could be a week or it could be 3 months.
Depends on how deep... thinking out loud that, I mean, that they have to be big so they can get down there to dig. They didn't have the drilling...
Oh, the backhoe. They brought the backhoe in. No. Well, if you remember the story of Charles Mully and the well, Jacob's well that he dug, they dug that with picks and shovels. They dug it with picks and shovels. Now that they have money, if they wanted to do a borehole, they would have somebody come in, like they did at Lodwar, where there was no water, and they bored 400 feet deep to find water. But they found Jacob's well with picks and shovels. They dug all the way down. And what they do basically is, you know, they dig it out wide enough to operate in, and then they keep going down and they bucket the dirt up and bucket the dirt up. And finally, when they find water, it fills all that up. It fills it up partway, you know. Water comes up into that space. Yeah?
What's Beersheba mean? Beersheba.
Gosh, I know this.
It's where Sheba in here.
I can't think right this minute. If you email me, I'll tell you, because I can look it up. But I can't think right this minute.
Well, here they call it because the two of them made an oath to each other.
Yeah, it may be related to that. I don't want to say no. I can't think right now. I'm sorry. I may have. What? The well of seven? Is that what it means?
That's what it says.
What's it mean?
Well of seven or well of the earth.
Well, there you go. That's in your study Bible, isn't it?
Yeah.
It means the well of seven. Remember the seven ewe lambs? Yeah, well, or well of seven.
Right.
So there you go. There's your answer. We have a scholar back there.
Okay, next question.
Huh?
Do you know what a tamarisk tree is?
No. I don't know what a tamarisk
is. A small tree that thrives in arid regions.
It's apparently something that grows in the desert.
Its leafy branches provide welcome shade.
It's not a hydrangea, I'll tell you that.
The unidentified bush under which Hagar put Ishmael.
Yeah, that's what you said. See, people are studying. They're learning how to find answers. This is great. So quit calling me. No, that's good. Any other questions that I don't know? There would be a lot of them, actually. He gives Abraham sheep to get a clear title to a well that already belonged to him. This is right relationship, which is true righteousness. He wants to make sure that there's a right relationship between him and this king who owns all this land. He goes the extra mile, doesn't he? I mean, theoretically, he can say, you know, you gave me the well in front of witnesses. But then if Abimelech gets to, you know, I got taken advantage of.
Why would Abraham dig a well in somebody else's property?
Well, Abraham's got to have a well. If he's a shepherd, he's got to find water. Did you ever see Lawrence of Arabia? Lawrence of Arabia, the opening scene of Lawrence of Arabia, it shows T.E. Lawrence with a Arab at a well. And what happened is that the camel rider coming from the distance and whatever. And after a while, the Arab realizes that it's another tribesman whose well this is. And he goes for his gun, and Omar Sharif shoots him down from off his camel because they had dug this well. And basic rule is that you dig the well, it's your well. They don't establish. It's not like you own, you know, 4/10 of an acre in the middle of something. This is a vast country. So. Well, I mean, he did. I mean, they did. They came in and said, "We're going to take over your well."
Yeah.
But he would. They couldn't function without digging wells. I mean, all through here, we've gotten digging well issues, right? Lot digging wells, Abraham's wells, fighting over wells, and in a desert, you got to dig for them. Okay. Does that answer it all?
Yeah.
Okay. It's one of the many ways the world they lived in was different than ours. Yeah, actually, in the movie, it doesn't show it as being that deep, but that's a movie. They actually had to go dig a hole for the scene, you know, whatever. So this is right relationship, true righteousness. Abraham builds an altar to God at Beersheba and worships him there in Philistia. So Proverbs 16 says, "When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him." I remember this proverb. I remember it. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And I find it's very often true. When I was younger, I was picking up enemies. You know, when you're younger, you do that. And like, for instance, an example is I'd be teaching a class, and somebody would come into the class whose sole purpose was disrupt the class. Or they would disagree with me, and they would want to make it into an issue. What I used to do was I would take them on and try to blast them out of their seat, or whatever. I would pray that God would bless them upside the head with a brick, you know. I was just kind of like, "Lord, deliver me from this idiot who's coming to my class and whatever." And God spoke to me about that, and he said, you know, it's not the way I would do this. And he said, what you need to do with these people is befriend them.
Oh, and that's why you're so nice to me.
It is, yeah. See, it works. You know, you're a pussycat compared to the people I'm talking about. You're operating with a good heart out of ignorance. These people were smart and evil. I did. And I remember there was this one lady who just loved to contradict me in pretty much everything I said. came from a whole different philosophical, political place. And I remember that, careful how I share this. I remember that one time when Nancy was gone, this lady had a project around her house that needed doing, and she was asking the class, anybody know somebody who could do this? And I said, I can do that. And she said, really? I said, yeah, I can do that. So I went to her house to do this project, which was a project I thought was going to take maybe an hour. Well, it took 6 hours. It was a much more complex project than whatever. But I did that. And then later, something happened, and her daughter needed some furniture and stuff for college, and we had some stuff, and we took it over to her. And we became friends. And we agreed to disagree on just about everything, but we became friends. And we're still friends to this day. And that's what God has shown me to do with people. And it's worked over and over and over again. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. So God was pleased with the fact that I wasn't trying to kill him or, you know, curse him or all that sort of thing. Revile him, whatever. Which made sense to me. But do we consider a right relationship more important than money? How does this relate to turn the other cheek? I remember when Ben wrecked Mark Dininger's car, that very famous incident where he slams into it. And so I got on the phone right away to settle with Mark on insurances and all that sort of thing and told him I would pay whatever they didn't cover. And he reminded me that the car was diminished because it's wrecked. And I said, I'll pay 10% more. He said, oh, thanks, whatever. I could have fought him over that, but look what I would have lost. Anything to be solved with money is no problem. Do we consider right relationship to be more important than money? How does this relate to turn the other cheek and give him your coat also? Same formula. Turn the other cheek, give him your coat also. You value the relationship more than money. Will we obey God and forgive our enemies in order to save the lives of our children? We're going to get a story here in a bit that's going to speak to that issue as well. So I won't do it now. Okay, what do we love? Who or what do we love more than God? It came about after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes, and he saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to the young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you. We will come back, he said. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son, like a wooden cross, laid it on Isaac's son, took his hand, fire, and the knife, and the two of them walked on together. So God tests Abraham's devotion, his obedience, and his faith. God tests us for our sake, not for his. God wanted Abraham to know that he was committed to God. God already knew what Abraham was going to do. But, you know, sometimes what happens is stuff comes up and you find out whether you're committed or not. Or you find out how far you're committed or not. Now, this is like a lot of biblical stories. It's kind of telescoped or, you know, shrunk down to the bare bones. I have no doubt that Abraham and God had long conversations through the night on this. I mean, I had no doubt that Abraham would have complained to God about this. But come morning, he went and did what he was supposed to do. Remember, he's living in a world, in a culture in which child sacrifice is the norm. It's the norm. It's what people did. And so even though God has never said anything to Abram before about child sacrifice, it's not unlike the gods to demand child sacrifice. And Abraham is sort of getting to know God. Remember, Abraham does not have a Judeo-Christian tradition. He's learning to know God as he goes. He's actually shaping the tradition. He's actually revealing God to us and how God acts and behaves. So, you know, we can think of Abraham as going, well, that's murder, God. I mean, that's child sacrifice. You know, you're against that. How do you know? Well, I read it in the prophets. Well, the prophets are 1,800 years later. You know, well, let's see, David spoke against it. That's two more, that's 2,000 years later. You know, well, you have to put yourself in these people's position. Abraham is following a voice that Noah told him about. Noah told him that God told him to take his family, get into this ark and close the doors, and turn his ears away when all of his relatives were screaming outside wanting to get in. Abraham winds up setting out to do what it is that God told him to do. He was told to go to the land of Moriah. The land of Moriah. Mount Moriah, the mountain of Moriah, is the site on which he attempted to sacrifice Isaac. And it is the exact spot of the altar sacrifice in the Jewish temple. When Solomon built it, he built it on Mount Moriah. It was actually the threshing floor of Jephunneh, the Jebusite, before David bought it from him. And David paid full price in order to not have a relationship issue. That's another one of those stories. So he puts the wood on him and has him drag it up the mountain. And he sets out to sacrifice his son there on the mountain. Like all ancient religions, people thought of God as easier to access from the heights. And Abraham wouldn't have thought any different than that. So the higher they got, remember Babel, the whole thing about building a tower up to God? Except they brought it up there to grab a hold of him and jerk him down. But remember that God later meets the children of Israel on Sinai. Jesus is transfigured on Hermon. So he goes up on Mount Moriah and he tells the young man who he's with, we're going to go worship and then we will return. We will return. Because Abraham trusts God. God told Abraham that he would have offspring through Isaac. And somehow or another, he's now gotten to the point where he realizes, if I kill him, God will raise him up. Because God has promised me offspring through Isaac. So he goes forward. How many of you want a scripture on that? In Hebrews 11 on the next page, 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendant shall be called." And he considered that God is able to raise men from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. Abraham goes up on the mountain to offer his son, but he also trusts God in the middle of conflicting data. God tests us for our sake, not for his. He wants us to know what is inside of us. I can't tell you how many times God has shown me what's inside of me, and it's not always pretty. You know, we have, I'll just speak for myself, you try to live a righteous life, and you try to do this, the Lord shows you things, you ask God to help you improve in those particular areas, and you're rocking along for a while, and you're going, man, I'm doing pretty good. And then something comes up, and all of a sudden, something comes out of you, and it smells bad. And you go, where did that come from? And you realize it was there all along. Yeah. God, it was a remnant of a cold potato. You know what movie that came from, don't you?
Yeah.
Scrooge. No, and so you realize, well, God in his mercy is not cleaning me up all at one time. Otherwise, it would be heart surgery and brain surgery all at the same time, you know. But he's doing it a little at a time. And you think, okay, I'm doing fine. And then, I mean, unless any of you all out there are Mother Teresa or north of Mother Teresa, this would apply to all of us. But maybe, you know, I don't doubt that I'm the greatest among the sinners, so you know, maybe you are. Past all this, you can pray for me that I get there. But there is within us that which is broken and flawed and corrupted, and we came by it naturally. And the trick is not to avoid it. The trick is to ask God, in his mercy and in his timing, with the proper anesthesia, to help us to get past this, or this. So he wants us to know what's inside of us. The process of passing the test moves it from theory to reality in us. We are not told how Abraham initially reacted to this command. Did he call out to God in pain, disbelief, and anger? This would have been understandable, but not productive in the long run. Did he passively obey without question or pushback? It's possible, but unlikely. We only read about his eventual response, and that's what God counts, our eventual response. God doesn't pay a lot of attention when we kick and scream and yell and whatever. All he's interested in is seeing is what's our eventual response.
Wayne, I can't read this without thinking about Isaac's response too, because he was 13.
Yeah, we're going to get into that, actually. We're going to get into that, but you're right. You have to think about what he was thinking. In Matthew 21, Jesus says, "What do you think? A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in the vineyard.' And he answered and said, 'I will, sir,' but he did not go. He came to the second son, said the same thing, but he answered and said, 'I will not.' Yet afterward he regretted it, and he went. Which of the two did the will of his father? The latter. He complained and bitched and rebelled, and then he thought better of it, and he went and obeyed. The first guy was, 'Oh, sure, yeah, I'll do that.' And then he just went and did what he wanted to do. Which one was the son to that father? Which one is God pleased with? The father was pleased with the latter, the one who kicked and screamed and yelled, but wound up doing it. God does not judge us for our pain-based reactions. That's important for us to understand. God does not judge us for our pain-based reactions. So if something comes along in your life and it's just overwhelming and you're upset and you're bitter and you're shaking your fist at God and you're angry and whatever, God does not judge us for that. He knows what it's like to have children who are by definition children operate out of emotions and pain. I mean, we got our own children, right? I mean, we can see them throw a fit and kick and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's not like you go, call my lawyer, I want to change my will. You know, this is, you know, you deal with it, but you're not going to throw him out.
Wayne?
Yeah.
So, if a person is hurt.
Yeah.
And because of this hurt, they strike out.
Yeah. Against God? Yeah.
Against God.
Yeah, well, they're going to.
Pain-based anger.
Well, I was talking about pain-based anger toward God. Well, if you strike out against another person, you have hurt your neighbor, and you're going to have to fix that with your neighbor. But God's not going to cut you off just because you had a human moment. Okay? We're not judged on the basis of our pain-based reactions to God. If you do that against God, you've not sinned, not in the real sense. If you do it against somebody else, you've sinned because you've hurt that person. You have to fix that. But He's not going to cut you off for it. I mean, you know, like we're a bunch of kids throwing tantrums all the time. I mean, we all, you know. Other comments? God is gracious, and He's loving, and He's kind, and He's a Father, and He's wise. Somewhere in here I say something. What I say is, and I'll find it, I say that one of the things that I learned is that God is at least a righteous a Father as I am. So whatever grace I might show to my children or however my reaction might be, God is going to be better than that. He's at least as righteous of a Father as I am. So if I can find myself finding compassion for my rebellious son, then I can believe that God can also find compassion for his rebellious son. We grew up in a time, and this has happened throughout the ages, when the church lost its power, its spiritual power, because it abandoned its relationship with God and exchanged it for ritual. And so it had no power. It had no witness. And in order to control its people, which became its goal, because a church like that becomes the tool of the state, that's what happened. Remember when the conquistadors came and landed in South America and worked their way north? Who did they bring with them? Missionaries who could try to control the natives by their fear-based religion. When the church loses its power, it resorts to fear. It tries to intimidate us into good behavior, threatens us with hellfire, excommunication, all manner of things, trying to force us by fear to operate in a way they want us to operate, and they call it the will of God. And it never is, never has been. The Bible says that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but power and love and a sound mind. Fear is not from God. When we talk about the fear of the Lord, we're talking about awe or respect. We're not talking about people cringing. God does not intend or want to generate that response. God does not give a spirit of fear. And people who try to use fear to manipulate you are never operating out of God, even if they're doing it from the pulpit, preaching hellfire and damnation and brimstone, sizzling on the thing and whatever. He does not judge us for our pain-based reactions, but for our obedience or lack thereof. Eventually, mature believers under discipline quit emoting like children. The sacrifice of Isaac happened on Mount Moriah, located 3 days from Beersheba. Abraham has 3 days to think about it as he walks. He had 3 days to think it over. You know, I've been through things where I was going somewhere to do something I had to do, and the whole time I'm going, I'm thinking about this. He therefore has plenty of time to back out. The Jews believe Solomon's temple, especially the altar of sacrifice, was built on the site of Isaac's sacrifice. 2 Chronicles 3:1, I'll tell you that. The Old Testament. Abraham's faith and his knowledge of God show up in verse 5. "We will return worship and return to you," he said. He trusted God to work it out no matter how impossible it seems. Now, even though he's come to this conclusion, I don't think he's looking forward to jamming a sharp knife into his son's heart. I don't think he's looking forward to binding him and putting him down on a wood stack. This is hard no matter what. Is there a questionnaire there?
I don't talk to Siri.
He trusted God to work it out no matter how impossible it seemed. He gave God credit for being at least as righteous as himself. He probably knows that Yahweh does not ultimately desire human sacrifice. Nothing about his relationship with Yahweh has indicated that. Of whom is Isaac a type? Isaac is a type of the son that God does sacrifice for us. But he does not sacrifice Isaac. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and he said, "My father," he said, "here I am, son. Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Isaac's doing the math. He can figure something wrong with his picture. One of the amazing parts of this story is the behavior of Isaac. We talked about this a minute ago. We are never told of Isaac's questions or protests about what happened. He never seems to show resentment or any long-term psychological damage. Isaac is one of the most peaceful people in the Bible. In fact, he's too peaceful. We don't get any sense that he was upset about this. Then when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built an altar there. He arranged the wood and he bound his son Isaac and he laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand, took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not stretch your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him, a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for burnt offering in place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide," as it is to this day. In the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. Then the angel of the Lord called Abraham a second time from heaven, and he said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, as the sand which is on the seashore. Your seed shall possess the gates of their enemies, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you obeyed my voice. Abraham returned to his young men. They arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived in Beersheba. Abraham was obedient, trusting in God to work it out. God did provide the animal, a ram caught in a bush for sacrifice. Abraham did not need to know God's hows and whys in order to obey God. Tithing probably would look like no sweat after this. From this story, we learn the depth of God's pain at the crucifixion of his only begotten son. It came about after these things, was told Abraham, saying, "Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz his firstborn, and Buz his brother, and Kemuel the father of Aram, and Hesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlap, and Bethuel. And Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to him in Nahor, Abraham's brother. And his concubine, whose name was Ruma, also bore Teba, Graham, or Gaham, and Tahash, and Maacah." Now, genealogies are always presented in the text for a reason, because they're trying to set you up for something, give you background for something that's coming. The ancients did not waste time by writing down trivia. They did not waste brain power by memorizing trivia. Remember, these genealogies had to be memorized. And so they just memorized the ones that they needed. That's why they're kind of straight line back through their family, with some exceptions. The purpose here is the introduction of the narrative of Rebekah. And the further purpose is to verify historicity. So we're getting ready to learn about Rebekah, and so they've given us this. Comments on all of this, the sacrifice of Isaac. Yeah.
I was thinking earlier when you talked about how God sometimes puts his battles with people, about people going through things.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Ben, and sometimes we had to pick our battles with him. You know, things you just let slide.
Yeah.
And some things you deal with.
Oh, well, there's no doubt about it. When we were dealing with Ben, you know, how long his hair was not the biggest issue of the day, or how low he wore his pants or whatever. No, you have to pick your battles. You have to let some things go, because, you know, if he doesn't get saved, it doesn't matter what his pants are. You know, if he doesn't work the issues out of his drug addiction and his disobedience to God, it doesn't matter how, you know. But that's right. That's how God is. God deals with, you know, we cannot assume. I cannot assume, because God has worked on me and helped me to get somewhere, that I am therefore clean or done. I can't assume that. It would be a mistake. I'll tell you, one of the things that's happened to me a number of times is that God tells me to do something and I balk. I told you a story one time about having to report to a guy who used to be my peer that I didn't like because he was a jerk. And I balk. I don't like it. I get mad. I fuss and cuss and whatever. I think about quitting the company and going somewhere else. All manner of stuff like that. And I'll stomp around in my room, as Nancy can tell you, my office, and I'm praying and shouting to God and whatever. And I'm being literal. And finally, I wear myself out. Like the kid who just cries until he can't do it anymore, and I wear myself out, and I just collapse into the chair, and I'm going, you know, I don't want to be at odds with God. And so as I'm sitting there exhausted and worn out from my tantrums, God can speak to me in the still small voice, and I'm listening because I got nothing else to do, and I begin to hear and understand. And I realize we have met the enemy, and the enemy is us. This was, you know, I was the one wrong here. And so then I've got to go and do it. Most of us, I don't know, but, you know, there are times when God says something and I'm immediately obedient. I wouldn't call it the norm. It happens a lot, but I wouldn't call it the norm. So this ongoing conversation between us and God, designed to help us to become more like his son Jesus, is always going to walk through the swamps and the mires and the bogs of our own corruption until we get to the place where we're beyond all that. Any other point, comments, right?
Wayne, sometimes when God speaks to us through someone else, we can just get mad at them.
Uh-huh.
You know, and just can't hear God at all.
Yeah, what she's talking about is when she's editing my books, and and she comes to, with these suggestions of how to be better, and my initial response is less than gracious. But then I go back and I think about it, and I go, you know what, she's right. So
I really wasn't thinking of that.
Well, but it's true.
There's 10 other things she was thinking of. But I was thinking of times, sometimes you say things to me, and I'm like, I don't see it at all, and I just get like really mad at you.
Yeah.
Until God, he sometimes just has to speak to me another way or something.
Yeah, it's not my job to confess your sin, so I went the other way. But yes, that's right. And, you know, stoning the messenger. But, you know, I've gotten to where when she suggests changes, they're just suggested changes. But it wasn't that way. I mean, there's nothing quite as personal to you as that thing you created. It's wonderful and perfect and whatever. I was looking for her to find the periods I'd missed, not the... You know, the capitalizations.
She's helping you make it more perfect.
Well, yeah. She was going like, you might want to leave this whole paragraph out. What? That's some of my best stuff. You know? Yeah, but it doesn't apply to this chapter, you know. Or this sentence is too long. It needs to be three sentences. It was good enough for Paul. You know? You're not Paul. You know, these sentences are too short. You should join those together. What do you know? I've got the master's in divinity here. I'm the one who's got written the dissertation. What do you know? So Christ-like. I'm so Christ-like. Anyway. Now, Sarah lived 127 years. This is that other story I was going to tell you about. Relationship and money. It's actually one of my favorite stories in the Bible. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose from before his dead, and he spoke to the sons of Heth. These are the people who own the land. These are the Arabs who own the land. Saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. I need a burial plot. The sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord. A little small L there, it's an honorific. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choices of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. Now, it is true that the people around Abraham see that Abraham is a man with the golden touch. You know, they see that. You know, and they said, you're a mighty Lord among us. You've been prospered, and everything you touch, you know, you spit and a well comes up, you know. Please feel free to bury your dead in any graveyard of ours that you want. Just go right and help yourself. None of us will refuse you the grave for burying your dead. So Abraham rose and he bowed to the people of the land, sons of Heth. And he spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me. And approach Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of the field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site. I want to pay him the full price for this thing, because I do not want to be beholding to him over this burial site. I'm not going to go bury my wife in one of your graves, because then you'll own me. You'll leverage me. I want to buy a piece of property. I want to pay full price. I want a clean title. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth. Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went in at the gate of his city. Remember, these things are always conducted at the city gate and whatever. So he answered and he said, if you will only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me. My Lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bear your debt. I am giving it to you for free. And now you will owe me. You owe me. Abraham bowed before the people of the land, and he spoke to Ephron, the hearing of the people, saying, if you only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. Then Ephron answered the Lord, saying to him, "My Lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 silvers a shekel, what is that between me and you? Go bury your dead." So he just told him, "I want to give you this. I mean, it's worth 400 shekels of silver. 400 shekels of silver is enough to buy Trump Tower. I mean, it's an exorbitant price." And he goes, "You know, it's only worth 400 shekels of silver. Please, just take it. It's a gift. And then you owe me a lot." This is the Arab trading scenario here. "What is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 silver shekels of silver, commercial standard. We're talking about not just cheap shekels, this is commercial standard. Shekels throughout the Bible have various weights. There's temple shekels, and there's commercial standard, and there's all these different shekels. So he pays him in commercial standard. "So Ephraim's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the cave in the field which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field, and all within the confines of its border, were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gate of the city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave, the field of Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth." Abraham wants to be dependent upon the Lord and only upon the Lord. And for the sake of right relationship, he will discard money. Money is not important. He wants a clear relationship with Heth, the people of Heth, with Ephron, over this issue, so that no one can say, "You owe me," or be resentful or anything. He pays full price. I had a friend of mine, a Jewish friend of mine, named Dennis Moel. And Dennis was actually one of the preachers in our group. And he said, "Wayne, only Gentiles pay retail." Only Gentiles pay retail. Well, Abraham paid retail. So Sarah lives until Isaac is 37. That's going to be important to us in a minute or two. Isaac is 37 when Sarah dies. He's 37 and unmarried. And his mommy has been caring for him all these years. Abraham wants to bury her in honor, not in some unmarked grave. Abraham buys a plot of the land from the Canaanites, Arab trader style. He enters into the delicate and sophisticated semantic negotiation dance, Semitic negotiation dance. "Gee, it would be nice to marry my beloved here, but I realize I'm just an alien among you with no standing." This understates his importance and invites them to invite him to bury her there. "Abraham, we would be honored to have you bury your dead among us." Gives them leverage with his rich and obviously blessed man. Leverage neither Abraham nor God want them to have. Leverage is undue influence. The world often offers to do us favors in exchange for owning us. It's always dangerous for us to become beholden to the world versus dependent upon God. The world wants to own us, and it will do things for us in order to own us. It will treat us nicely in order to own us. You know, if we do something that sort of points out that we're Christians, and the world gets angry with us, and we go, "Well, maybe I should not do this so they won't be angry at me." They own us. They own us. So he wanted to be dependent upon God, not the world around him. It's always dangerous for us to become beholden to the world versus dependent upon God. Jesus warned us, "Woe to you when men speak well of you." Jesus said, "Woe to you when men speak well of you." If Hollywood is praising you, if the marketplace is praising you, if the world is praising you, let it be for your good deeds, not because they're trying to leverage you with all of that. Jesus said, "Be careful when men speak well of you." Free is often too expensive. You know, I don't know about y'all. We've all got our stories. But I remember once, and Nancy and I were newly married, and we got this thing in the mail that invited us to come up to French Lick, Indiana for a deal there. Nancy and I had actually done our honeymoon in French Lick, Indiana. Part of it anyway. We left early. But we should come up there because we had won either a color television set, something else, you know.
Like a Lazy Boy recliner.
Well, that's the third one was a Lazy Boy recliner. Okay, so we were offered these three gifts. Crystal, a set of Crystal, and Lazy Boy recliner. We were newly married. We were sitting on an old couch with holes in it, with a gold throw rug over the thing, and we had end tables that were made out of cardboard, out of plywood, and painted green. And so, you know, a Lazy Boy recliner, a new television, whatever. So we thought it was worth the hour and a half drive to go up there. So we did. We went up there. And, of course, it was a spiel about how we should buy in and all this kind of stuff. You know, we just smirked and said no and smirked and said no and smirked and said no. So they said, okay, well, let's see what you want. You want a Lazy Boy recliner. I thought, that's good. So we went to pick it up. We walked in, and they handed us a little box. And we opened it up, and it was a frame. It was a aluminum frame that went down like this and whatever. And there was this orange thing that slipped over the flame with something like that. It was for fishing. So when you sat on the bank, you would put your back up against it while you were fishing. And it was called Lazy Boy. It's a Lazy Boy recliner. Nothing's free. Nothing's free. We once bought a set of encyclopedias that were free. These are absolutely free. Absolutely free. But all you need to do is to pay royalties for the artist and everything for a period of time. I mean, they wound up costing us $350. So, which was in those days the going rate. So between those two events, we discerned that nothing's free, ever. So when someone says, come and do this for free, psh, nothing's free. Nothing's ever free. Nothing's ever free, ever. Don't believe it. It isn't true. It's not free. I would like to take you to Manciano's for dinner so that you can listen to a 2.5-hour thing about how you should invest your money. Nothing's ever for free. Free is too expensive. There are numerous other biblical stories that make the same point. He who gives the gold rules him to whom the gold is given. It's the golden rule. He who has the gold rules. Here's a similar story in David's time. This I was referring to earlier. Oh, I got to quit. I'm sorry. Well, we'll just start there next time. I didn't realize where I was. Well, it's going to be the same kind of story. We'll start there next time. There's mesmerized, Nancy. There's mesmerized. Okay, somebody play us out.